Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we're approaching the one-year anniversary of the expansion of health insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act. We'll take a look at the highs and lows and look to what's ahead next here in California. We'll also get the scoop on one of Fresno's favorite holiday traditions in downtown. But first, the recent killings of two unarmed black men at the hands of white police officers in Ferguson, Missouri and New York City have not only brought the issue of race and law enforcement to the headlines, they've also brought the ancient institution of the grand jury to the national spotlight after similar bodies in both states declined to bring charges against the officers involved. Some have questioned the effectiveness of these secret panels, yet they remain an important part of our legal system today. Joining us now to tell us more about the grand jury concept, its origins, and what it means here in Central California, we have the soon-to-retire Justice Robert Oliver of the Fresno County Superior Court. Your Honor, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you, Joe. And it's Judge Oliver, but Justice would be a little higher rank than
yeah,
mine.
We haven't promoted you to the Supreme Court just yet, but I suppose that option still exists. Let's talk about the grand jury itself. Where does this idea come from?
This really goes far back in time when folks were looking for a way to resolve differences. It's an evolution of investigation and fairness going back to King Henry II in 1166. He established 12 good and true men in various shires or villages to ferret out bad acts. And they had such things as then as a trial by cold water, where they would send someone into the pond, and if they were guilty, they floated. If they were innocent, they sank. So it's rather a mixed message. But that going on to the Magna Carta, and then the barons wanted a trial by your peers, which we can talk about later because we don't do that.
So we've had so much discussion about the grand juries in those two cases back east. That's one type of grand jury there. Give us the lay of the land, because when we use that term, it applies to different bodies in different states and even within a state.
There are generally in the states a civil grand jury and a criminal grand jury. The civil grand jury, or the grand jury system in California, is by our Constitution. The civil grand jury explores virtually all manner of, I'm going to call it globally, government issues. It's the beauty of the grand jury is it is made up of members of the community. They can investigate areas of concern without going through the middlemen or going through elected officials. And that's what we generally have. There have only been, I think, 12 criminal grand juries established in Fresno County since 1997. The civil grand jury is made up of members of the community. If there is a criminal grand jury called, and that's optional with the district attorney, that is then those members are made up of 19 folks that come from the jury pool of nearly 285,000 members of our community.
So why would one of those criminal grand juries be called rather than going through the normal process with a prosecutor in a preliminary hearing in front of a judge?
The reasons will vary. As oftentimes, it may be of the extreme complexity. I know we had a criminal grand jury in Fresno that had, I think, around 20 defendants dealing with some sexual acts. They may establish a criminal grand jury for a high-profile person in order to properly and fairly bring matters to the attention of the grand jury, which may issue a true bill or fined by what's generally called a probable cause standard that it should go forward. That's really in the discretion of the elected district attorney. Seldom used, I might add. Yeah.
Is there an advantage in those high-profile cases from a prosecutor standpoint of having this not a public hearing, to having it in secret? What is there advantage, disadvantage, why in high-profile cases?
Joe, you'd probably have to ask the respective district attorneys. I obviously make it clear I'm not speaking of any particular case where our canons preclude that. But the district attorney has that judgment. They may believe it's appropriate and, frankly, more efficient to bring a matter to a grand jury, because in a grand jury there is no defense attorney, but there's a very, very detailed protocol. Grand jurors are allowed to ask questions. Only lawful evidence is introduced. There is discussion that it is not the most appropriate way to bring a matter to the attention of the judicial system, for it may be cause for a trial. However, in the case of a high-profile person, as an example, if the jury finds that there is not probable cause, then they have avoided that publicity. I would add that under the rules in California, specifically, sympathy, public opinion, or public feeling must not sway the jury. That's in Penal Code Section 939.8. And the finding would be that a person of ordinary prudence and caution could entertain a strong suspicion of guilt of the accused. And that is essentially the standard that a judge uses when a matter is brought to the attention of the criminal justice system through a preliminary hearing or preliminary examination.
We're talking about California's grand juries with Fresno County Superior Court Judge Robert Oliver today. Right now talking about criminal grand juries, and we'll move on to the civil grand jury in a moment. There was an article in the New York Times this Sunday discussing the nature of criminal grand juries, and in it, critics raised a number of concerns, and you alluded to one of them. First, that there's no the prosecution controls the process, and there's typically no cross-examination, no opposing counsel for the defense. Why does the process work that way?
Through the history of the evolution that we spoke about, it does have that limitation by many. The underrepresentation of grand jurors is one of the criticisms, reflection of a community bias. In fact, the makeup of the grand jury, if it were not done through the regular jury process, could be skewed because it may not reflect the face of the community. And sometimes irresponsibility, a grand jury, it's called a rogue grand jury. We've not had that in Fresno. And then finally, the secrecy of a grand jury is criticized because folks say, as we're expressing now and speaking only generally, that they don't know what happens within the four walls of the jury, and the person who is being considered for a true bill or indictment does not have an attorney. But I would point out that there is a wide range of flexibility that the grand jury has. They are not mere sycophants or robots simply listening to the whim of the prosecuting attorney.
So Tom Wolfe's famous comment, quoting the judge in The Bonfire of the Vanities, that he could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich if that's what the prosecutor wanted, maybe is a little hyperbole?
It is a phrase that has gone down in the annals of paralegal phraseology, I'll say that.
Yes, indeed. When we were talking before this segment, you had mentioned that California is one of the only states to have the grand jury system ensconced in its constitution.
Yes.
That is somewhat unique.
Well, I don't know how many other states. I know there's about 25 or 30 states have criminal grand juries as options, as the use of a grand jury for a criminal indictment. So we have it. And in order not to have a grand jury, there would have to be a constitutional amendment. But let me strongly point out that particularly the reality is that our civil grand juries in Fresno County are the voice of the people. It's called a watchdog. That's another hyperbole that I think aptly fits the role of a grand jury. They are able to explore matters that come to their attention or that they are that are brought to their attention, again, without the intermediary of an elected official. It's as close as you can come as a member of the community to be up close and personal, other than acting as a regular juror, which I'm very fond of, by the way.
Yes, indeed. And you are a big advocate of the Fresno County Civil Grand Jury and have been for some time. Let's talk some more about that. And one of the big differences is how the civil grand jury is that panel is selected. It's by application, is it not?
It is by application. Historically, in the olden days, the judges would get together and figure out a number of folks that might be eligible, and the names were drawn out of a hat. It came to the reality is that we don't have our pulse around the county as we should. We do a wide-ranging information process by which folks hopefully learn about the opportunity to serve as a grand juror, which is upcoming, by the way, towards the first of the year. And you can apply by looking at the Fresno Superior Court website. We have an application. It's simple. We will interview you, and we'll have a number of folks, typically 70 or 80, that will end up being evaluated by the Superior Court. A number of those will be drawn and put into a figurative hat, and 19 jurors will be selected, less than one or two holdovers. So it's a great opportunity for members of the public to participate in the governance of their community.
What is that interview process like? I imagine that could be potentially intimidating for some people going in front of a panel of judges?
We generally will interview folks individually. We're all nice, warm, and friendly folks, and it's designed not to be a star chamber proceeding, but simply to evaluate folks and get a sense of what they're about. I often tell people the only requirements are you need to play well with others, not bring any baggage into your duties as a grand juror. This is not the place to express your long-felt concern that there is a absolute problem in a particular area. You're there to be a juror in the truest sense of the word. And if you can do those things, you can be a grand juror.
You mentioned a couple of holdovers. Is that typical for a grand jury to give some continuity in terms of this is how it works. I kind of know the ropes. I did this last year. Or is this a body that kind of goes in its own direction for the whim of the people on the panel?
The presiding judge has the option to have a holdover or two, generally no more than two, sometimes only one. But other than that, the grand jury is given an orientation, and the presiding judge has some general oversight, and they have a legal counsel from the district attorney's office, actually, even for the civil matters, but it's up to the grand jury. They figure out what their time frames are, what is within their purview, and what, given the priorities of time, what elements of issues brought before them they wish to explore. So they're in charge.
You mentioned those issues brought before them. How does that work? Does someone have a concern? Maybe they're a whistleblower. They know something that is of concern to them in local government. Do they call up a grand jury hotline and say, hey, I'm concerned about what's happening in the town of any town in Fresno County, and I have some information I think you should know about?
All of the above. There are some things the juvenile justice system, the penal system, that by statute, a very narrow statute, need to be explored each year. Other than that, it is what comes to the attention of the grand jury. I would point out that if you go to the Fresno Superior Court, look to the grand jury website, you will find a very simple form by which you can bring your concern to the attention of the grand jury. They then evaluate what's before them, and they've been as wide as back 10 or 12 years ago examining the Fresno County Coroner's Office. They do have, by the way, a new office now. Need for technical vocational education, the Lanier Community Service District, City of Kerman property sales, the Sheriff's Fleet Management Program. You see, it's wide and ranging. I will point out that the Fresno County Juvenile Justice Campus, which is now down on American Avenue, came about, I am convinced, by the grand jury's scathing and proper reports every year, which were looked at appropriately by the Fresno County Board of Supervisors, and within their limitations, they knew there was a problem. That continuing report by the grand jury, members of the community, coupled with the wonderful article Hall of Shame by the Fresno Bee, tipped the point. I am convinced that without those two things, one, the grand jury bringing it to the public's attention, and two, the Bee's report, we would not have a new juvenile justice facility.
We're talking with Judge Robert Oliver of the Fresno County Superior Court on Valley Edition today. Are there specific qualifications to be on the grand jury? Are you looking for a certain sort of person who has a certain background in law or something like that?
Absolutely not. People will often say, well, gee, I'm not a lawyer or not an accountant. How can I be a grand juror? As I say, here are the six things that I give when I interview prospective grand jurors. You have to be able to listen, a rare art, by the way. You don't have no baggage. It is you don't come to the table with a predetermined idea of what should happen. Play well with others. You're a member of a group, of a committee. You must have some time. They say 40 or 50 hours a month. That's a time commitment. That's a substance. Nobody's ever missed a vacation as far as I know. And you have to be an optimist. You have to look at a issue, a problem, and say, let's find out about this. Let's not start from a standpoint of despair. And life experience. Now, do you have life experience at 25? You bet you do. And we would love to have younger members of our community apply to be considered as a grand juror. There's not an age requirement. We would like seniors to apply. We would like members of every aspect of the community, diversity, geographic, to consider grand jury service. In my 20 years of having oversight over our grand jury and jury committee, the comments that folks have indicated, this has been a great life experience. I think bodes well for the commitment of time and effort that members of our community will find well-placed if they exert themselves towards grand jury service.
Now, unfortunately, we can't talk about the things the grand jury is working on right now until their final reports are issued.
And I wouldn't know what those are.
Exactly. But you mentioned that this is coming towards the time that people would be signing up or submitting their applications. What is that timeline like? Is the new grand jury impaneled or is it created in January or do you?
We begin the process in January. The new grand jury will be sworn in July 1st, but we accept applications all year long. And actually, once you have applied, once you've been interviewed, your application will stay in the pool and you'll be contacted each year by Sherry Spears, our wonderful officer, jury manager, to see if you're interested in continuing to be considered. So Fresno County Superior Court, look for the grand jury pull down, and you'll find all the information you need, including a brief summary of what some of the requirements are. But skill sets, none, except play well with others, listen, and be able to be a team listener and then an individual decider.
We're talking about the difference between the different sorts of grand juries in California, between the civil grand jury, which serves as a watchdog on local government and other issues, and the criminal grand jury, which seeks indictments. Judge Oliver is with us today. You mentioned that since 1990, Fresno County has only had a criminal grand jury a handful of times. Was it different before that?
12 times since 1997. Our tradition in Fresno County over the last 50 or 60 years has not been to use the grand jury for lots of reasons. I think as you number one, the sheer quantity of work that is required when folks are arrested and charged with a crime, and their right to this preliminary process requires frankly, time that a grand jury wouldn't have. Now, though the federal government has a different process where they have grand jurors meeting almost every day. Having done preliminary hearings, preliminary examinations for a number of years, I think that is a most appropriate way to try to hear most cases to see if there is probable cause. And the old saws of ham sandwiches notwithstanding, there have been any number of cases in which a judge acting, sitting as a preliminary examination judge, has not found there to be a ham sandwich.
Before we go, I want to move on from the grand jury to some other issues that are before the court right now. A couple of things. Number one, we've seen big cutbacks to the judicial system across the state. In Fresno County, hours have been cut. Some remote courthouses have been shuttered. The workload, as I understand, is intense. Is there any hope for improvement, any hope to be optimistic at this point in terms of the judicial system we have in the Superior Court level throughout California and its workload and the funding that's coming in?
Optimism is in the mind of the beholder. I think Fresno County can be proud of its judicial and court system. Our budget has decreased by about $5 million per year. Our staffing is down about 125 folks. We are still getting cases out the door. We have very few what we call NCAs, no courts available for civil cases. We obviously hear criminal matters within the constitutionally prescribed time. Yes, has it been tough to close outlying courts? You bet it has. The reality is the third coequal branch of government, the judicial system, third coequal branch, takes about 1% of the general fund budget. We have we believe that the budget has been cut to a point, and some counties, frankly, are in much more dire straits than we, that it hurts the public. You know, we're going to get along one way or the other. We'll do what we can, what's necessary. But the public is hurt when they do not have access to the courthouse.
Last month, California voters approved Proposition 47, sentencing reform measure, which reduced penalties for certain crimes that had in the past been felonies and now are, I suppose, misdemeanors. Your colleague in Yolo County Superior Court Judge Dave Rosenberg told the LA Times, and I quote, "Prop 47 was a smoke bomb dropped in every courtroom in California, and we're working on clearing out the smoke." Here he's talking not passing judgment on the measure, but in literally about the influx of people who are coming into the courts now seeking to have those prior records reviewed in front of a judge. Is this the experience that we're seeing in Fresno County as well?
Absolutely. Our executive committee, Judge John Conklin, our presiding judge, Judge Hillary Chittick, were working in advance of the election on the assumption that this might pass. We have a plan in place that we are executing to be able to take care of those matters that are properly coming before us. I think a smoke bomb is apt in that once the dust clears or once the smoke clears, we're going to find that there are unintended consequences. One of the unintended consequences is folks that before were, as part of their sentencing structure, were engaged in rehabilitation, drug treatment, et cetera, are unfortunately now choosing to say there's under the present system and my sentencing, there's no need for that, so I choose not to have access to this rehabilitation or drug treatment. I think that is sad and unfortunate, but that's a reality. But we as a court will deal with what the public and the legislature has put in place.
You're soon to retire, to leave the bench. What's next for you? What will you miss about your service on the courtroom?
Wow. I have been privileged to serve as a judge for nearly 20 years, and as of December 19th, 41 years as a lawyer and a judge. The opportunity to watch great lawyers at work, the opportunity to see people have their day in court, be it a civil matter or a criminal matter, the opportunity to preside over the happiness of an adoption, the sadness of presiding over a sentencing where the courtroom is full of people representing members of the victim's family, representing members of the defendant's family. These are sad and tragic, but they are part of our system, and to be able to have a hand, hopefully, as a fair and impartial judge. You know, we are not advocates, and we have to remember that. And I think sometimes it's forgotten in the public eye. We are dealing with the facts and the law to the best of our ability. And just as the grand jury makes it clear that grand jurors are not to bring their personal ideology into the court, into the bench, we as judges leave those at the door.
We've been talking to the Honorable Robert Oliver of the Fresno County Superior Court. He is leaving the bench as a judge with the court later this month. Judge Oliver, thank you so much for joining us today.
Joe, thank you very much.
And stay with us. We'll be right back in just a moment on Valley Edition and look back at the first year of Obamacare. The ups and downs. We'll talk to reporters from the Center for Health Reporting at USC straight ahead on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. College may prepare students for good careers, but these days it also pushes many already poor students into lifelong debt. In this segment of FM89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State biology professor Dr. Madhusudan Kati asks how much American society truly values a university education.
As we head into another holiday season, we gather to give thanks for what we have and are urged to share with those less fortunate. However, as a professor at a public university, I am appalled by the fact that more and more of my students are among those less fortunate. Yet we are not doing enough to help them. A recent survey at Fresno State tells me that 1 in 3 students in my classroom face food insecurity. Another 20% are close to the brink. My students are literally hungry, and not just for knowledge. Most will stagger to the finish line still hungry, graduating under a life sentence of crushing debt. Their stories give new meaning to questions about the value and the price of a university education. It is hard not to find America's student debt burden immoral when the Congressional Budget Office announces that the U.S. Department of Education profited to the tune of $51 billion on student loans this year, a profit higher than Exxon's. Yet we tell kids they must go to college to get a good career and take loans to invest in their future. While developed nations like Germany offer free university education, American public universities face shrinking budgets. So they keep hiking tuition, hire more low-wage adjunct faculty, and keep salaries for tenured professors stagnant. Some campuses, like my own, even charge hidden success fees, nickel-and-diming students in tacit acknowledgement that mere tuition is not nearly enough anymore to ensure their graduation. We might as well ask students to plop down their credit cards when they arrive, as we put their diploma on layaway to be collected after they've paid the full price of tuition over 4 to 6 years. How much can or should they care about actually learning anything on an often empty belly, given the high price tag on that diploma? We have let education become a commodity transaction between overworked, underpaid, insecure faculty teaching overloaded classes full of hungry, indebted students facing uncertain futures. Fresno State now offers starving students a free pantry stocked with food recovered from its farms, although teaching them to farm might be more useful than charity. The federal government may lower interest rates on student loans. Real lasting solutions, though, require fundamental changes in how we fund and run universities. American society must search its soul to determine the real value of education, not just for the individual student seeking a job, but for a once advanced nation that has lost its way. Lady Liberty may hold a beacon welcoming the hungry, tired, huddled masses to America. But for my university classroom, I urge you to send me eager, well-fed students, hungry only for knowledge. For the Moral Is, this is Madhusudan Katti.
The Moral is a production of the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State and Valley Public Radio. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station or the center. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. Listening to Valley Edition. January 1st will mark the first anniversary of the expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act. At the heart of the landmark health law is the idea that by reducing the number of uninsured, Americans will get healthier, thanks to regular checkups, and a reduction in the chronic and often catastrophic conditions that drive up healthcare costs for everyone. It may be a simple idea, but implementing this incredibly complex law was anything but easy, and so far it's been filled with plenty of highs and lows. Here to take a look back, we have on the phone with us today two reporters from the CHCF Center for Health Reporting at USC, Deborah Schock and Emily Bazar. They've just finished a piece that ran this weekend in newspapers across the state, including the Fresno Bee and Bakersfield Californian, and on websites like kvpr.org, where you can find the story today. Emily, I want to start with you, as you've been covering the Medi-Cal and covered California angles. What's maybe one thing that the state did really well in retrospect and one thing that didn't exactly go according to plan?
Right. Well, there are actually, when I talk to experts about how the Affordable Care Act implementation or the first year of it went, there are two big things that stand out. One is unique to California, and one is not unique to California. It's something that happened nationwide. Let me start with that one. One of the biggest successes of the Affordable Care Act is that people can no longer be denied coverage, no matter what their medical history, whether they've been denied in the past for something as simple as asthma or they've had something more serious, heart attack, cancer, anything like that. they are no longer allowed to be discriminated against by insurance companies in that way, and especially for people with chronic or serious health conditions. That is a huge shift, a revolutionary shift, in fact, in health care coverage. So that's number one. Number two, in California, really the success of the first year has been in the numbers. California beat projections in terms of enrolling people in Covered California, which is our state health insurance exchange. 1.4 million people were enrolled in the first go-round, and right now, you know, people drop off because they get jobs and insurance for their jobs or they stop paying. So right now there are more than 1.1 million people enrolled in Covered California, and 90% of those get tax credits, which subsidize the cost of their monthly premiums, which is also a very big deal. But number two, as part of that, is that the Medicaid expansion in California, our Medicaid program is Medi-Cal, and the numbers are absolutely monumental. In fact, since January 1st, more than 3.5 million, or actually I think it's since the enrollment started, more than 3.5 million people are newly enrolled in Medi-Cal. And this number always just, I can't believe it when I hear it. Right now we have 11.3 million Californians who are part of the Medi-Cal program, which is nearly one-third of our population, and that's monumental.
And maybe what's one thing that didn't quite go as people expected it to, or something that's been a big challenge? I know there have been several.
Hard to choose one. Implementation has been rocky, and the effects of the ACA have been inconsistent and uneven. Some people are doing great. They're saving hundreds of dollars per month on their premiums. Other people had a really hard time. Let me choose probably the biggest complaint that I receive. I write a column that is direct to consumers about Obamacare, and probably the biggest complaint in the last year has been narrow networks. Many insurance companies that are participating in the private market and the Covered California Exchange dramatically limited the number of doctors and hospitals that participate. So people had this expectation, because a lot of the messaging around the ACA was that you get to keep your doctor, you get to keep your plan. Well, that didn't always happen. For some it did, but a lot of people had trouble finding doctors or hospitals that accepted their new insurance, and that was a very big problem for a lot of people.
I want to bring Deborah Schock into the conversation. Now, Deborah, you've been following the hospital and provider angle to this story, and what Emily just mentioned is one of the maybe unintended consequences, but it's also one of the areas where it's an example of how the law helps to keep down costs, or at least its intent to keep down costs, in that it tries to align the health insurance system with the provider networks and try to achieve costs that way. What have you seen from that story? What's the biggest story to come out of this one-year retrospective from your perspective?
I would say that the big alliances of hospitals and doctors. Hospitals, your listeners may well have seen billboards or whatever advertising new partnerships among hospitals in your area. And that's because the bigger a hospital group, the stronger it is in negotiating contracts with insurers, and the more likely it is that they're going to be able to stay afloat and keep costs down in what is a very turbulent healthcare market right now. And there are good things about that, which, you know, again, a lot of those alliances are focusing on preventive care, they're beginning to look a lot more like Kaiser Permanente. They're trying to prevent big cost surgeries and whatever by treating patients early. But on the other hand, a lot of hospitals are struggling, we found. The small hospitals, rural hospitals, hospitals that traditionally treat the poor. We're seeing more small hospitals going out of business. And so it's really a story of the big getting bigger and the smaller struggling.
We've seen a variety of things in this area. Currently, there is a bit of tension between Community Regional Medical Center and Children's Hospital Central California. There's also been tension between a major local physicians group, Sante Community Physicians, and St. Agnes Medical Center, which itself recently aligned with Dignity Health. We've also had up in the North Valley a medical center in Turlock purchased by a major for-profit hospital company. In some ways, are these things that predated the ACA, the trend for consolidation? Is the ACA accelerating that change, or is this an entirely new trend that we're seeing?
No, you're right on the mark. It's simply taking a trend that was happening and sort of, you know, fueling it up. It's going a lot faster. And it sounds like what you're know, what your listeners are seeing, you know, right there in your area is pretty much representative of what's happening statewide.
Again, we're talking with reporter Deborah Schock and Emily Bazar from the CHCS Center for Health Reporting. You can find their story, Health Reform in California, a State of Accelerating Change, on our website at kvpr.org. I want to ask you about the woman who's at the center of your story. How typical is Gail Fullback's story? And I'll let Deborah start this one out.
Okay. Gail is, it's quite a story. It's probably the most striking success story we saw. Gail lives in the Sacramento area. She owns and operates some soda machines. You know, she spends a lot of her life, you know, very physically active, you know, lifting bottles and cans. And she and her husband were struggling to pay a monthly insurance premium of $2,555 a month on their old plan. They switched to Covered California, and right now they're paying per month $165. And I should assure you that is, we did a lot of research. That's by far the biggest success story we found. But there are still problems. A lot of people are paying more under Covered California. Others are seeing increases this year, headed into next year, and also, like, even Gail, with that reduced cost, ran into some big problems in trying to keep her regular doctor under the state plan, and that, too, is very common. So it's a mixed bag.
Turning back to Emily, you've been doing the Ask Emily column in papers across the state for, well, over the last year now. How challenging has this story been to cover just as a journalist and to try to answer people's questions?
It's been pretty challenging. It's also been very rewarding. Since I began, I've received about 2,000 questions and comments from people, and that high number is just a testament to how confused people are and worried people are about this big change in their lives and the fact that there's going to be a tax penalty now. I hope most people know that by now, but starting, well, with this year and 2014 tax year, there's going to be a tax penalty if people don't have health insurance for the vast majority of the year. So, and that's most people. There are some exceptions. But so in the sense of being able to answer people's questions, it has been very rewarding. On the other hand, answering people's questions has been very challenging. I am finding that even and especially among sources, the people who are running the show, I often get they don't know the answer, or I often get incorrect answers. And there have been several instances where I've had to correct them and have them change information on statewide websites and that sort of thing.
So looking ahead, you mentioned the tax penalty start this year. What else is to come? A year ago, we heard so much talk about the delayed employer mandate. Is that coming? What is on the horizon as we look ahead to 2015 and beyond?
Yes, the employer mandate is taking effect, and it's interesting. I plan on covering this in my column. I am surprised at how little angst there is, frankly, around this, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. There are concerns that some employers will try to shift some their employees into state-based exchanges or the federal exchange around the country rather than paying for them themselves. They would opt to, you know, employers that don't, large employers that don't cover employees are going to be penalized, but I think some are thinking, well, I'd rather pay the penalty. It'd be cheaper than actually offering insurance. So there's a concern about that. There is a very big Supreme Court decision coming on the horizon. The Supreme Court has agreed to take up a case that looks at the tax credits that are offered to people through the federal marketplace, the federal exchange. The vast majority of states actually don't have their own state-based exchanges like California. They use the federal health exchange, which we heard had a lot of problems last year, which is called healthcare.gov. And this case is going to look and see whether actually it's or the law allows tax credits to flow through that federal exchange to people in states that don't have their state-based exchanges. You might be wondering why I'm even mentioning this, because California has its own state-based exchange. If those tax credits are considered illegal or improper for those, the majority of states, that could create instability in the system, which in turn could affect us. So technically or theoretically, you would think that even if they strike those down in those many states, California can keep on trucking with its tax credits. But that may not be the case. Those tax credits are really one of the big engines of the Affordable Care Act. And if you don't have those, it would be very hard to keep this going.
And Deborah Schock, what do you see coming in 2015 and beyond?
I would say more of the same. And, you know, I'll tell you, we talked to a lot of doctors around California, and some of them said they felt pressured to join larger physician groups. That's going to continue. Some complain about some relatively unknown parts of the ACA, such as one that's pushing them to invest in expensive electronic health record systems. They cost a lot of money, and like many systems, they can crash. But on the other hand, I still remember an interview that my colleague Lauren Whaley did with a Dr. Hector Flores, who treats patients in some of the low-income areas of Los Angeles County. And he told us that under health reform, he has seen the number of his uninsured patients cut in half. And that's the good news coming out of this, because if indeed we have more insured people, that means less people going to very expensive emergency rooms at hospitals for care. And in the end, that could mean that we all may pay less money for health care. But this is like one of the grandest experiments ever in the history of American health care. And, you know, it's very hard to predict.
It's an experiment which we will continue to follow into 2015 and 2016. You can see the article on our website, Health Reform in California, a State of Accelerating Change. Again, a product of the CHCF Center for Health Reporting at USC. It ran in newspapers across the state this weekend. There's also some videos and interactive elements online at kvpr.org. Deborah Schock and Emily Bazar joining us today on the phone. Thank you both so much for joining us. And stay with us in just a moment. A Fresno holiday tradition returns to downtown Fresno. We'll get the latest on the Christmas parade taking place this weekend, and also an opportunity to put on those skates and maybe enjoy the ice in downtown Fresno. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This weekend, a Valley holiday tradition returns to the streets of downtown Fresno. Here to tell us more about this weekend's Christmas parade, is Aaron Blair with the Downtown Fresno Partnership. Aaron, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks for having me.
And also welcome to Fresno. Aaron is the new CEO of the organization that is the Downtown Business Owners Group and is very active in downtown revitalization. The Christmas parade returns to Fulton Mall this year. What's coming up this Saturday? Tell us about the parade.
Yeah, Saturday, it's going to be great. We have the parade will kick off around 10:45. Officially, it's listed as starting at 11, but we kick off just a couple minutes early so that we can make sure that it gets down the mall and then over to Kern. It should be a great parade, as usual. Most of our businesses will be open. A lot of the restaurants will be open. So if anyone's looking at opportunities to come downtown and, you know, see the parade, then stay for lunch or come for breakfast and then stay. We also will have the ice rink going on. It's a big day at the ice rink after the parade. A lot of people will hang around and go ice skating and continue some of these new family traditions that people are starting by coming back to the center core and ice skating as a family.
I definitely want to ask you about the ice rink in a moment. What's the route for the parade, and where can people park? What's the parking situation on Saturday?
Just like it is always on the weekend, parking is completely free. So, you know, you can park along any of the streets. You know, almost all of the streets will be open unless, you know, you're trying to park on Kern or near Fulton. That's where the road will be closed there. But all the garages will be open. The Spiral Garage is a great garage to park in on the corner of Enyo and Van Ness. All the underground garages will be open, and we will be posting from our website and our Facebook and Twitter page a map to show people where, you know, the easiest access to those particular parking locations. So, again, you can kind of park and land anywhere on the street, and access to downtown is very simple and easy.
And your route is primarily on Fulton Mall?
Yeah, it'll start, it starts near the CVS pharmacy there. On Fulton Mall, goes all the way down the mall and then turns and goes up Kern Street, and it'll end there at the end of Kern Street near the convention center.
And again, we're talking with Aaron Blair of the Downtown Fresno Partnership. You mentioned the ice rink. This is something that began, yep, I think, 2 years ago or so. Maybe it's three, yep, already. Tell me about how this new holiday tradition is working out. People are really enjoying it, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, the ice rink, we're in our third year, and this year we actually kind of moved the rink around and moved the entrance and all the activity to the Fulton Street side of the rink, and we've added some new things with Santa's Workshop in partnership with IdeaWorks. The rink's open every single day. It stays open later, obviously, on Friday and Saturday. It stays open until 11 p.m. It's pretty inexpensive. For a family, you can buy a season pass for your family for $99, and those are actually been widely popular this year. A lot of families are coming down and came down really early and started buying season passes so that throughout the holiday season they can bring their family down and enjoy the rink.
I've heard some people describe it as sort of a big city experience. You've got the tall buildings around you and the ice skating. What's that experience like?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a big city experience. And I mean, especially when you're out there skating and you're right next to the Pacific Southwest building, which obviously is our tallest and most recognizable building in downtown. And again, it's just something that, you know, we're going to continue to expand upon. And as Fulton Street reopens here in the next, you know, year and a half or so, the ice rink will be able to evolve and become even, you know, a greater experience. So that's what we're looking forward to doing. And again, yeah, the ice rink is a great family tradition. If you haven't come, it's a great tradition to start. Even if you can't skate, it's fun to fall down together.
Yes, indeed. You mentioned the changes that are on the way to the Fulton Mall. What is the latest there? When can Fresno residents expect ground to be broken? If you haven't heard, the existing pedestrian mall is planned to be removed and two-way traffic restored by the city of Fresno. What's the status of that, and what would that mean for the ice rink next year?
Yeah, well, it's we're still on pace for early next year to begin construction. And, you know, all the property owners, all the businesses, they're so excited about the future of Fulton Street. And, you know, we're excited, too, because now we have the opportunity to work with the artist families and really restore all the great art that is along Fulton Street and actually give it more visibility than maybe it has had in the past, you know, by restoring it, by creating apps that people can come and see the artwork and learn more about the art. And for, as far as the ice rink, you know, if we have the ability to keep installing the rink during construction, we will do such. Again, it's just, you know, family traditions and have been created, and we want to, you know, be there to help continue doing such.
Are the business owners down there at all concerned about the impact the construction might have on their businesses?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, with any type of construction, especially something this major, there's going to be some sort of impact. And, you know, that's what our organization's here to do. I mean, we're going to do everything in our power and ability to help these businesses. I think with the construction, they're, you know, the city is really focused on, you know, what can they do to minimize the impact on businesses. You know, obviously there's going to be an impact, but we're going to do everything we can in terms of whether it's events and marketing and just utilizing all of our power to make sure that we're being as helpful as possible. That's what we're supposed to do, and that's what we're going to do.
We've been talking with Aaron Blair with the Downtown Fresno Partnership. They're presenting the annual Downtown Fresno Christmas Parade this Saturday. It starts at around 11 or maybe a little bit earlier on the Fulton Mall, and then the ice rink runs now through January 19th, including holidays. And you can find more information at downtownfresno.org. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Anytime.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, talk@kvpr.org, or if you're on Twitter, follow us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.